Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 200 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Anita Mason takes us to a tiny house in the west of Ireland to escape the world, and Duncan Forbes shares his own small and well-gardened corner of it in the fourth instalment of our Location and the Writer series. First, here's Anita Mason.
I went by coach because it was ridiculously cheap, and every other way was ridiculously expensive. Also, every other way would have involved a car, and what is the point of getting a car to the far west of Ireland and leaving it to sit outside your window for 4 weeks? I was going to write. After I'd written, I was going to walk by the sea. So I went by coach. The coach left Bristol at 10 p.m. It had come from London. A few passengers were Irish. Most were young Londoners with leaky headphones. I sat clutching the knapsack containing my sleeping bag that I would need on the ferry, which was too bulky to fit into the luggage rack and wouldn't go under my knees. At some terrible hour, we arrived at Fishguard. We huddled in an unheated hut until waved onto the boat. In a cavernous bar, we stretched out on the bench seating in defiance of the notices. It was impossible to sleep. To a grey dawn, we arrived in Rosslare. We stumbled about and got back on the coach and bumped through southern Ireland. At Cork, the air was damp and smelt of river. I found thin coffee and a cardboard croissant and a lady's in need of refurbishment. At 10:30, it felt like four, I got on the bus for Killarney. On the bus, they were talking about the priest. I dozed. At Killarney, I had to change buses again, but had time to find a cafe called Jam, where I wolfed a mountain of shepherd's pie before getting on the bus for the Ring of Kerry. All I had to do now was be awake when we got to Waterville. If I slept through it, there wasn't a bus back. They were talking about the priest on this bus, too. I was awake for Carsevine, the stop before. A grin was starting to work itself across my face because I'd made it. The line of shops, the weather station, the turning to Ballinskellig's Bay, tussocky grass and a dark blue sea, a pattern of fields and houses, mountains behind. Then the road bent westwards and I glimpsed it. The curve of coloured houses, the pebble strand that was Waterville. Beside the fading Botticelli Venus someone had painted on the wall, I hauled myself off the bus and gasped in a torrent of air. Then I set off walking the short distance to the house, the little house I remembered, where you pushed open the front door and there was the ocean on the far side of the windows, and so I did, and there it was, and I flung down my suitcase and laughed like a lunatic for joy. It was always like that. I didn't count the times I went there. I was just so thankful always that I could. It belonged to the sister-in-law of a friend and was sometimes empty, and she said with great generosity that I could use it in return for not very much and write. A tiny garden in which grass grew sparsely, but a clump of thyme flourished. Opposite that, a small Protestant church. The house, the end of a terrace, stone-washed, modest, containing no hint of what lay within. Within was, how can I describe it? It felt like the kernel of a nut nestled inside its shell. A kitchen area, a big wooden table, then chairs, a fireplace, and beyond that a tiny patio and the sea. Upstairs, two bedrooms, bathroom, a balcony, and the sea. The house was dominated by the sea. It belonged to the sea. It almost was the sea, I sometimes thought in my delirium, filled with its tumble and murmur, really not quite in my right mind, but so happy. In the morning I would watch the sun throw the dawn onto it from above the rooftops. Gradually the sun would move over the house, and in the evening it dipped, in full view of my windows, over the curving promontory that sheltered the bay. It went down in such glory that I could not move from where I sat, until the last shred of crimson had leached into the dusk. Sea-watching, sky-watching, did I ever write? Oh yes, writing takes a lot out of you. If you're doing it well, it takes everything out of you. You have to keep it always in front of you, the thing you are trying to create. You have to keep it alive and luminous and not get too close to it and not get too far away. And understand it without completely understanding it and see everything it involves. It is difficult. You need endurance and a particular kind of vision that sees both the landscape and the blade of grass. The place gave me that, with its purity and its quietness. It gave it to me. I got up, breakfasted, and wrote until lunchtime. If I needed any shopping, I went to one of the two little supermarkets that stood just around the corner and sold exactly the same thing, except that one had a line in peat and the other had a line in ice cream. I came back, lunched on Irish cheese and soda bread, and wrote. If it was winter, I would go out in mid-afternoon to collect driftwood along the rocks. In summer, I often walked around the headland. I would crunch down the pebble slope and turn right. The beach was sand-streaked with broad outcrops of rock, thickly massed with seaweed reaching out into the shallows, creating pools over which children hung intently at weekends. Further on, the low, grass-crowned cliff got higher, the pebbles got bigger, now they were the size of a dinner plate, and the boulders, which stood each like a king in its own small realm of sand, surrounded by a tiny moat that threw back the blue of the sky. These boulders all of a sudden consolidated themselves into an apron of rocks like seals, stretching themselves towards the Atlantic, and at the same time reared backwards up the beach, so that there remained only a high ridge of pebbles to walk on under what was now a lowering cliff, and this was the headland. I was always conscious, walking this part, that there was no way up the cliff. This made me very aware of the time it took to get around the headland, which always seemed longer than it should be. It was like one of those curving country roads that goes on curving for much longer than it ought, bringing to mind that chilling Daphne du Maurier story about the tower in which there are more steps down than there were up. And surely by now I should be on the other side and be able to see any. No. For there was the golf course to negotiate, and a creviced plateau of peat, and the rusting scrap of fence I always forgot about, before below me was the flash of pale gold I sought. The beach at Inny, I thought each time I came to it, must be the most perfect stretch of sand in the world. At low tide it seems to stretch forever before it meets the trembling lace of foam. There the water is warm, shallow and inviting, and only when you raise your eyes and take in the width of the bay do you realise the power of those breakers that are hitting the sandbar. But the beach is tranquil. Drifts of seaweed blow across it, a few small pebbles wink, and over it, like clockwork toys, run the sanderlings. With their long legs, they are like tiny storks, and so fast do they run, their legs are just a blur. They run and peck along the water's edge, and take wing if you come too close. I walk on towards the river. At this point it can't be seen, only a vast expanse of sand meeting an endless sea, and edging it the low elbow of land. But as you walk, the land nudges in, and you see you are approaching another, gentler headland, while immediately ahead the sand is becoming plashy, full of water. Then abruptly it is water, a fast-flowing ribbon of it coursing down the beach, and here I've almost fallen over them. A set of ancient blackened stumps juts out of the sand. They are the timbers of a cargo boat, a local man told me. She was wrecked a century ago, taking coal to Limerick. The crew were buried in the Protestant churchyard, just over the road from where I stay. Crossing the river is hazardous because of the current. I did it once and followed the beach on the other side for as far as it went, but I liked it less. On the near side, I walk along the narrowing strip of sand between river and cliff, where the river, broadening, has created numerous islands, half mud, half sand, soft, like glistening pancakes, where one cannot set foot, and therefore longs to. The birds possess them. At a certain point, the strip of sand would vanish, and here the river was deep. It was time to go back. In winter, to a peat and driftwood fire, and perhaps a trip to Raymond's bar. He did the best takeaway fish and chips I'd ever tasted, and a very passable curry. The house, the village, the shore, all seemed perfection to me. I did some of my best writing there. I wrote a long, sustained, difficult passage in a novel about the conquest of Mexico, which I do not think I could have written anywhere else. Anywhere else, I would have lost my hold on it. I cut a novel down to half its length with a ruthlessness I probably could not have commanded if I had not been living with the clarity of those skies, the relentlessness of those tides. That was the last time I was there. And it was the last time. When I heard the house was up for sale, for a fevered few days, I contemplated buying it. I could only have done that by selling my flat in Bristol. I would have had to live there. Of course, I wanted to live there. But how much did I? So far away from anyone I knew. So far from an airport. From the nearest hospital. I had recently been ill. In Bristol, the BRI is just down the road. I did nothing, and the moment passed. And now, of course, it would be complicated. Brexit. No Irish passport. But sometimes I wake in the night and there's a sound like the rustle of the sea on pebbles. And I know it isn't. It's some urban sound, perhaps a distant motor. But it could be, couldn't it, I think in my half-waking state, the sea disturbing the shingle. And I hear it, what does Yeats say, in the deep heart's core.
That was Anita Mason. Next, here's Duncan Forbes on Yew Tree House.
It was described to us by the previous owners as a quirky house. Those were the very words of the Scottish eye surgeon who lived here before us. Why hasn't it sold already? I asked the estate agent who showed us round. Because of the road. Yew Tree House lies between the post office to the south and the church to the north, with a pub on one side and a chemist on the other. These provide four cardinal points for us locally. Outside our front door is the churchyard, and then St. Mary's Church, which dates back well before the Reformation to 1280 AD. With its smells and bells, it sometimes seems as if the Reformation has passed St. Mary's by. On the churchyard side, we look out over the generally well-tended graves to the limestone church itself, flanked by two Irish yews. A small culvert runs under the alleyway and past our house, taking water from the hills to the monks in the priory who are no longer there. It then runs down to the mill house, which is, of course, no longer a watermill. With its acreage of greenery, the churchyard forms a nature reserve for the local wildlife, grey squirrels and mice, jays, sparrows, blue tits, and ubiquitous pigeons. At night, owls can be heard to hoot and hunt in the vicinity. The churchyard is alleged to be the second most haunted in England, but as I told a camera crew, I've seen many more grey squirrels there than ghosts. Six different men are designated to keep their sector of the churchyard mown and tidy, and because of its traditional appearance, the church is a popular venue for baptisms and weddings. Funerals also take place there, but the graveyard is almost full, so that gravedigger scenes are relatively rare. They do happen, and the digging and thump of the spade can sometimes be felt and heard from the house. Then there is the smell of freshly opened earth and the sound of topsoil and gravel falling onto a corrugated iron sheet. Stephen, the postman, comes across the churchyard to deliver our mail, and it turns out that he is a ceramicist and a reader too. Along with the pizza and curry ads, he brings the books we buy, and we have conversations between the holly and yew hedge and the clipped laurels. On the other side of the house, past the patio and garden, there is the carport and the short driveway on a steep gradient down to the high street. Because the church is only 60 paces to the north, people often ask if Yew Tree House was the rectory, but the answer's no. The old rectory is a handsome Georgian building by a bus stop further down the street, and the new rectory is a modern brick dwelling with solar panels and a recent Marian statue. The core of Yew Tree House is dated to roughly 1830, and so it passes for late Georgian, but it really belongs to the short reign of William IV. It has been much altered over the years, and so it is not listed. Ironically, the working red telephone box at the bottom of the drive is a Grade 2 listed item, although it is more often used as a urinal than a phone. Opposite our gateway, the post office is a hub of activity for the village, which is really a part of the town. The entrance to the shop is a newsagent's and confectioner's, with some stationery and greetings cards. It's amazing how much stock they carry. Glue? Yes. Batteries? Yes. The post office part is up four steep steps and is wonderfully convenient for us. Post, cash, euros, parcels, passport renewals, car licences. At Christmas, they're always busy and amused us a few years ago by asking us whether we wanted Madonna and Child or Wallace and Gromit on the stamps. Next to the post office is a salon called Jane's Hair and Beauty, which advertises Kevin Murphy treatments and employs three glamorous beauticians who sometimes seem to attend to each other's appearance at the end of the working day. A short distance up the street, there is Prestbury Stores, housed in an old thatched building. It is now Mr. Tweeney's Budgeons and is open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m, and the new stock is excellent. The shop is opposite the King's Arms, without an apostrophe, which is a carvery and it does good business. The food is reasonably priced, but best described as nosh. The High Street used to be on the A46 to Winchcombe and Stratford, and although the road has been demoted to the B4632, it still carries much traffic. Some container lorries and a training outfit called MT Vehicles, empty, get it, use the route and add to the congestion locally. Although there are double yellow lines outside the post office and our gates, there is much opportunistic parking on the lines and over the pavement, and so it's possible to witness some truly dreadful driving there. Further up the High Street, the local butchers, run by older Nigel and youthful Nick, is called Waghorns, and they used to have a rather macabre retro model of a Frisian calf called Milky advertising their trade. Nick is called Veal, which seems a great name for a young butcher. Under his influence, the shop now combines an excellent traditional butcher's with a modern gourmet delicatessen, stocking everything from local cheeses to artichoke hearts and sometimes potted shrimps. For many people, Cheltenham, and particularly Prestbury, means proximity to the racecourse. We thought of taking in paying guests for bed and breakfast during race week, which I call the Festival of the Horse, but there have been enough horror stories to put us off. In one friend's house, a punter was still so drunk in the morning that he spilt shampoo in the shower, slipped on it, fell heavily, broke his arm, and was taken to casualty. Weeks later, our friend received a solicitor's letter threatening to sue her. On Gold Cup Day, we hear the helicopters of the plutocrats going overhead, and when the wind is blowing from that direction, we can hear the amplified commentary on the jump races and the eager, alcoholic roars of the crowd as the horses near the finishing post. We have help with the garden from the marvellous Matt, who comes once a week on Wednesdays for 2 hours. When he arrived, he was just 21 and was described to me as a fine, upstanding Gloucestershire lad. And so he was and is, although he's now a married man with a young daughter and son. He will attempt most things in the garden, and among many other tasks, he has erected a split chestnut paling fence, felled a frost-bitten cordyline australis, removed the rotten pergola and its kiwi fruit vine, blitzed weeds, clipped hedges, edged the lawn, swept leaves, removed moss, stabilised paving stones, planted thousands of bulbs, cleared a drain, and removed a hula hoop lodged improbably high in the yew tree branches. All this has been done cheerfully and to his own admirably high standards. We did not buy the house for its garden, but it turns out to have excellent soil, sandy loam, according to Matt, and judging from the fresh graves dug in the graveyard, the sumptuous topsoil is about 6 feet deep. Before our arrival, the garden at Yew Tree House had suffered from years of neglect. So I know about the holly and the ivy when they are both full grown. In fact, in our first year there, I thought the house should be renamed Ivy Lodge. It also seemed as if we had inherited the national collection of Iris fetidissima, or stinking iris, with its strappy evergreen leaves and distinctive orange arils grinning beadily away all winter. There was much initial work to be done, clearing and cleansing the garden, and I made a collection of found objects, beer glasses, Guinness sleevers, dead bouquets, black underpants, a glasses case, plastic litter, copper coins, lost toy cars and a rubber octopus, for example. I called it garden archaeology, and I've kept some items as exhibits. There were also fossil bivalves, mollusks and belemnites from the Cotswold chippings, welcome souvenirs of life on the seabed eons ago. This whole limestone area was once under a Jurassic sea. The churchyard and the grave inscriptions also tell their own stories. There are graves, ancient and modern, a tabletop grave and one in the shape of a mini pyramid. There's one for a consular official who died on his return from Scutari, and Assumption who died of wounds. Like the church itself, they indicate the history of the place and of these islands. I have seen no evidence for the supernatural, whether ghosts or gods, even at Halloween, when local youths emerging from the plough or the King's Arms like to frighten girlfriends by leaping out from behind gravestones and making ghoulish noises. Before we arrived, I had not realised just how emblematic the situation of Yew Tree House was and is. In front of the High Street side, there is all the business of the daily traffic on an overused B road. The post office and newsagents are often busy. The chemist and Presbury stores, along with Jane's Hair and Beauty and the King's Arms, have their regular clienteles. The High Street offers food, money, commerce, people, and the noise of vehicles, police cars, ambulances and lorries. The garden provides a buffer zone with its conifers and shrubbery, its small circular goldfish pond, and the yew tree, which seems older than the house and is itself a symbol of longevity. Its roots go about 2 centuries deep or so. The garden is now full of summer flowers, orange alstroemeria in particular, along with sweet williams and cornflowers, roses and yellow sisyrinchium. On the other side of the house, there is the churchyard with its silent occupants and quiet neighbours, a large chestnut tree and the ancient church. Graves, crosses and tombstones go back from the present day to inscriptions from other centuries. A church clock, with its gilded Roman numerals and quarterly chimes, calibrates the transience of the hours. High Street, garden, house, churchyard and church. The image suggests the passage of time and its cyclical nature from birth to death via occupations and preoccupations, news, commerce, nature and the seasons. Here, a changing community rests on the bedrock of a fossilised sea.
That was Duncan Forbes. You can find out more about Anita Mason and Duncan Forbes on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 200, which was recorded and produced by the Writers Aloud team. Coming up in episode 201, Stephen Wyatt takes us to an unusual destination, the Gallifrey One Convention, where participants are enthusiastic, oddly dressed, and gratifyingly appreciative of his own 30-year-old TV script. Then Doug Johnston reminds us that no completed novel lives up to what its creator initially imagined, and explains how a complete failure 3 books in led him to find his true writing voice. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. www.rhz.co.uk. Thanks for listening.